Chapter 3. Justine had a driver circling the block, waiting for her to call. She did. I walked her to the elevator, holding her hand in my gloved fingers the whole way. We didn't speak again. She smiled at me, though, when the elevator arrived and kissed my fingers through the glove. Then she was gone. Technically, there was always a huge, empty place inside me. That's what the hunger was, after all. So I told myself that this wasn't any different, and I went back to my apartment to get to work. Purely for form, I tried Harry's home and office phones before I left my apartment, but I got no answer at his apartment and only his answering service at his office. I left a message that I needed to talk to him, but I doubted he would get it in time for it to be of any help. I grimaced as I took my cell phone out of my pocket and left it on my kitchen counter. There wasn't any point in carrying it with me. Technology doesn't get along well with magic. 20 or 30 minutes in Harry's company could kill a cell phone if he was in a bad mood, less if he was actively throwing spells around. My own remedial skills weren't any particular threat to the phone, but once I brought up the tracking spell I'd need to find my brother, my reception would go straight to hell anyway. Harry waxes poetic about magic. He'll go on and on about how it comes from your feelings, and how it's a deep statement about the nature of your soul, and then he'll whip out some kind of half-divine, half-insane philosophy he's cobbled together from the words of saints and comic books about the importance of handling power responsibly. Get him rolling, and he'll go on and on and on. For someone on Harry's level, maybe it's relevant. For the rest of us, here's what you need to know about magic. It's a skill. Anyone can learn it to one degree or another. Not very many people can be good at it. It takes a lot of practice and patience, makes you tired, leaves you with headaches and muscle cramps, and everyone and their dog has an opinion about the correct way to do it. Harry's a master of the skill. As in simultaneous doctorates from MIT, Harvard, Yale, and a master's from Oxford. By comparison, I went to a 6-month vo-tech, which means I skipped a bunch of the flowery crap and focused on learning some useful things that work. It took me a couple of minutes longer than it would have taken him, but I used the silver pentacle amulet my mother had given me for my 5th birthday to create a link to Harry's amulet, a battered twin to mine. Early springtime in Chicago can come at you with a psychotic array of weather. This spring had been pleasantly mild, and by the time I'd used the tracking spell to catch up to my little brother, the day had faded into a pleasantly brisk evening. I held the silver amulet in my right hand, its chain wrapped around my knuckles, 4 or 5 inches above the pendant, left dangling. The pendant swung steadily back and forth in one direction, no matter which way I turned, as if it had been guided by a tiny gyroscope. I'd paid a small fortune to park the Hummer, money well spent. Now I followed the swing of the pendant and the spell guiding it across the grounds of Millennium Park. Millennium Park is something fairly rare, a genuinely beautiful park in the middle of a large city. Granted, the buildings spaced around the grounds look like something inspired by an Escher painting and a period of liberal chemical experimentation in an architect's underclassman years, but even they have their own kind of madman's charm. Even though night was coming on, the park was fairly busy. The skating rink stayed open until 10 every night, and it would only stay open for a few more days before it would shut down until the seasons turned again. Kids and parents skated around the rink. Couples strolled together. Uniformed police officers patrolled in plain sight nearby, making sure the good people of Chicago were kept safe from predators. I spotted Harry stalking along the side of the skating rink, walking away from me. He was head and shoulders taller than most of the people around him, professional basketball player tall, and rather foreboding in his big black duster. His head was down, his attention on something he was holding in his hands, probably a tracking spell of his own. I hurried across the distance to the skating rink to begin shadowing him. I realized I was being followed about 20 seconds later. Whoever they were, The Stygian hadn't told them they were dealing with a vampire. They hadn't stayed downwind, and a stray breeze had brought in the aromas of a couple of dozen humans who were nearby, the reek of a couple of trash cans, the scent of several nearby food vendors selling various temptations from their carts, and the distinct rotten meat and stale sweat stench, badly hidden under generous splashes of axe, of two ghouls. That wasn't good. Like me, ghouls can pass for human. They're the cheap muscle for hire of the supernatural world. Doubtless the Stygian had hired them on against the possibility of interference from the Venatori. One ghoul I could handle, no problem. Though they were tough to kill, strong, fast, and vicious as the day is long, that's nothing I haven't slaughtered before. Two of them, though, changed the picture. It meant that if they had any brains going for them at all, they could make it very difficult, if not impossible, for me to take them out without being incapacitated myself. True, hired thugs generally weren't known for their brains, but it wasn't a good time to start making assumptions about the opposition. I quickened my pace, attempting to catch up with Harry, and pretended I hadn't noticed the ghouls. Harry turned aside and hurried across the park grounds toward the pavilion. It was an enormous structure, which I always thought looked something like a medieval Mongol's war helmet. Giant Attila's chapeau turned into a building where concerts were held on a regular basis for the good people of Chicago. Tonight, though, the pavilion was dark and empty. It should have been locked up, and probably was. Locks, though, never seemed to pose much of an obstacle to my brother. He went to a door on the side of the stage building of the pavilion and opened it, vanishing inside. I hurried after him and called out his name. I was still a good 50 yards away, though, and he didn't hear me. The ghouls did, though. I heard one of them snarl something to the other, and their footsteps quickened to a run. I ran faster. I beat them to the door, and my demon and I shut it behind me, hard, hard enough to warp the metal door in its metal frame.
"Harry!"
I shouted.
"Harry, we need to talk!"
The ghouls hit the door and tried to open it. They didn't have much luck on the first try, but they settled in to wrench it open. The door was only metal. It wouldn't hold them out for long. The interior of the building was empty and completely unlit, except for the faintest greenish radiance, which came through dimly, as though reflecting from many other interior surfaces several rooms away. My demon had no trouble seeing through it, and I went through the halls in silent haste, following the faint light source toward its origin. One of the ghouls ripped the door off its hinges, the metal shrieking behind me. One of the ghouls bounded through, snarling, the pitch and tenor of its voice changing as it came. It was changing form, growing less human and more dangerous as it ran down its prey. I rounded a corner and ran toward a tall figure in a dark coat at the end of a hall, lit by a green luminescence, and realized within a few steps that the figure my tracking spell had taken me after was not my brother. I drew the Desert Eagle from under my coat and opened fire. The form crouched, lifting an arm, and bullets bounced off something and began skittering around the concrete of the hallway. A magical defense. The Stygian. A hand lifted, and a sphere of light flashed toward me. I dove under it, but the incoming spell matched my movement and fell to meet me. There was a flash of brighter light and an instant of heat that I expected to become agony. Instead, there was just a whirl of confusing dizziness, and then I was back on my feet. Just as the first ghoul, its arms now half again as long as they were, and ending in grotesque claws, its face distended into a gaping fanged muzzle, rounded the corner and leapt at me. I'd brought the kukri. It's a weapon that served the Gurkhas well for a couple of centuries, and with good reason. The bent, bladed knife, the size of a small sword, carries a tremendous amount of striking power along its inner edge when wielded properly, enough to strike limbs and heads from bodies, even when used by relatively small and less powerful mortals. In the hands of a vampire, it's the kind of thing that jabberwocks get twitchy about. The first ghoul led with a claw that was fast, but not fast enough. I left it on the floor of the hallway, hamstrung it on the backstroke, and emptied the Desert Eagle into its back as it tried to flee, shattering its spine. It's one of a couple of ways to put a ghoul down fast and for keeps. The second ghoul came at me a breath later, and hesitated for maybe a quarter of a second upon seeing what was left of the first ghoul. That isn't a long time in human terms. When you play in my league, the ghoul might as well have put a bullet through its own head. It would have amounted to the same thing. I threw the kukri hard, my demon lending me strength and precision, and the knife split the ghoul's skull open like rotten fruit. The other way to put ghouls down fast. I slapped a new clip into the Desert Eagle and had it trained at the far end of the hall when the dark figure reappeared, lit by a faintly glowing green crystal she carried in her left hand. Her dark hair was tied back from her perfectly expressionless, motionless face, and her eyes were unreadably reptilian. The Stygian. "Valera, isn't it?" I asked her. The second ghoul's momentum had carried it to the ground beside me, and it lay there on his back, the handle of my knife sticking out of the center of its face, the interior of his skull open to view. One of his legs was still quivering.
"Or are you Genera?"
"It matters little to us," she replied. Her voice was hollow, empty of something vital. It sounded about as much like a human voice as the old 60s electric pianos did like actual pianos.
"You cannot win, Venator. The lexicon Malos will be renewed. Depart now. Live to fight another day."
I leaned down and jerked my gore-soaked knife out of the dead ghoul. Then I started a steady, deliberate walk toward her.
"That's what the other two members of the Stygian Sisterhood I've met have said. So far it hasn't worked out that way."
I started planning my shot. Every schmuck who can conjure up a shield that bounces bullets thinks he's hot stuff. But it takes concentration to do it, and the shields aren't omnidirectional. A ricochet shot can bounce right around a conjured shield, and besides, if I could get her focused on the gun, she might not realize I was using the knife on her until it was too late. There was a nice, smooth, polished metal surface behind her, the cover to what must have been a heating unit or a lighting control panel or something. The steel looked heavy enough to suit my purpose. If I could put part of a shot into her back, even just a few fragments from a shattered bullet, it should be distraction enough to let me put her down.
"Let's make this simple," I told her. "Hold still, smile pretty, and your sisters can have an open casket service."
Her lower lip twitched down away from her teeth, in a gesture that looked like something that had never been human, attempting a smile.
"But yours," she said, her voice suddenly a purr, "will never know you."
I stepped forward ready to shoot and caught a flicker of my own reflection in the metal behind the Stygian. It wasn't me. The man facing me wasn't me. He looked older, rough-faced, with shaggy graying hair and a scruff of a beard. His jaws were slightly distended, as were his lips, and I pegged him at once as a ghoul who had not quite managed to completely hide its true nature under a human outer appearance. I lifted my left hand and the knife in it, and the ghoul in the reflection did the same thing. The Stygian gave me another not smile and vanished around the corner. It took me a second to recover and go running after her, but I needn't have bothered. A heavy door clanged shut as I rounded the corner, and flickering motes of greenish light danced over its surface before leaving me in total darkness. I'm not a member of the elite when it comes to the use of magic, but I knew better than to try to force that door against whatever energies the Stygian had laid across it in her wake. I cursed savagely. The entire affair had been an ambush, and I had walked right into it. This was the difference between Harry's use of magic and mine. The link between our amulets was strong enough that his more sophisticated spells would never have been deceived. The Stygian must have used some kind of masking enchantment to trick my own grade school version of a tracking spell, and then employed an illusion to give herself the appearance of my brother once she had lured me into position to do whatever it was she had done to me. Why change my face?
The members of the Stygian sisterhood were no amateurs when it came to dangerous, even lethal magic. Why had she done that instead of, for example, setting my intestines on fire? Even if my demon had been fully fed and at peak strength, I doubted I could have survived something like that. Now that the actual fighting was over, I began to feel the fear. Had the Stygian wished it, I would be dead right now, and the knowledge was sobering, frightening. Harry had occasionally accused me of being reckless and overconfident, which is, believe me, hypocrisy of a staggering magnitude. But in this instance, he was probably right. And after expending so much energy on running, fighting, and bending steel with my bare hands, I was hungry. The park outside this building was just brimming over with happy, oblivious kine. It would be so easy to cut one out of the herd, some tender little doe, and I had to focus and concentrate. I wasn't working with a safety net. Another stupid mistake could kill me. Get your game face on, Thomas, I snarled to myself. Get your head together. The darkness of the building was almost complete, but my demon let me see clearly enough. The ghouls were already rotting away. They'd be nothing but a stinking mess of sludge in a few hours. We were far enough into the building that I doubt the sound of the shots had carried out of it. But the cops on patrol in the park would notice the door the ghouls had torn off the building, probably sooner rather than later. I couldn't stay there. I found another way out of the building and hurried back toward my truck. I couldn't trust my tracking spell, obviously, which meant that I had to find Harry another way. Karen Murphy of Chicago PD might be able to find out if anyone had seen his car, but I had no way of knowing Harry would be in it, or even nearby. And even if I did find him, it was going to be hell convincing him of anything when a stranger walked up, told Harry that he was his brother, and asked him to abandon the case. First things first, I decided. I had to find him, or none of the rest of it would matter. I knew someone who could help.